Thank you. I should say that Gillian made up that title. so this is my proper title. I have not much intention of talking about epigraphy, and how could I after the last paper anyway? So the paper I'm actually going to present today is based on some research that I've undertaken on the Peloponnese, as Stephen has said, and I'm going to look at a closer examination of community interaction, routes and landscapes to understand the process. To this end, I'm also going to have a look at some comparative data with other regions in the Eastern Mediterranean. But before I start, of course, I would like to thank Cilliers, Julian and Ariana for the wonderful opportunity to gather with so many friends and colleagues who've been working on similar themes in different areas and different periods, some with similar approaches and some with different approaches. And actually, I'm glad I've come now to speak, because I've spent most of the morning writing on my paper going, note, as Ellie says, and as Joe said, all of these kinds of things. So you'll hear some echoes of what other people have said in this paper now. So, from the 1st to the 4th centuries, literary data attest to the presence of Christian communities in Greece, but, more often than not, they remain invisible in the archaeological record. As we'll see here, it's to a large degree explicable because of the slow assimilation of Christianity, even after it becomes the state religion. However, there's an expectation of visible differences, in part because many of the written sources polarize communities, Christians and non-Christians. In the late antique period, it would, of course, have been in the interests of Christians, writers in particular, to promulgate the idea of Christian victory in the face of adversity, while non-Christian authors such as Eunapius describe a dark time in the 4th century. For example, in his Lives of the Philosophers and Sophists, he discussed the general gloom that descended over the fair earth, and for Greece specifically, the overthrow of temples which ruined the country. This actually contrasts with sections of the Edict of Theodosius, which actually suggests that investment in sanctuaries, in polytheistic sanctuaries, was suggested. I mean, this wouldn't have necessarily been out of the ordinary. It would have been in the interest of the imperial officials to preserve the city, to make sure everything was being cared for in any case. And we have lots of evidence, for example, of investment in theatres too. Furthermore, archaeological data, as we'll see shortly, indicates the active steps that were undertaken to sustain the status quo as much as possible. The desire to maintain sanctuaries makes sense in light of the necessity to legitimize the church in its new community culture and indeed identity. However, such views are not so easily highlighted when contemporary approaches to this period have been traditionally seen in a strict dichotomy between Christianity and polytheism. The slow pace of religious change in the shared traditions as seen in Achaea and other parts of Greece has been well documented by scholars such as Sirardi, already mentioned, Foschia, and indeed Amelia, who's here too. They've noted how the endurance of polytheism has been seen primarily in relation to Christianization processes. Moreover, it's clear from the archaeology that religious practice in the Roman and late antique periods was actually quite fluid, with Christians using polytheistic traditions and non-Christians using Christian traditions. And I mean, it's not notable in any particular way. It's perfectly acceptable. And just as much as recently views on the Jewish communities in Greece have changed to suggest that they were much more integrated, the same can easily be said too of Christian groups. Sociological approaches have identified two source processes for religious or social change, and these two processes are tension or emergent. And partly due to a reliance on written sources, Christianization has traditionally been seen in terms of a tension process, a tension theory, where change grows from unrest such as urban decline, sanctuary closure, or even earthquakes. But as we'll see here, the archaeological data suggests much more of an emergent process in the Greek provinces. So a lot of what I'm doing draws on sociologists like Mintzberg, who talk about strategic change. And within that strategic change, there are emergent strategies and deliberate strategies. And if we're talking about the Christianization process, you can think about deliberate strategies in terms of ecclesiastical desires to Christianize. and then emergent strategies which may come about in different ways from that. But in terms of the evidence that we've seen before, we're clearly dealing with a bias. And this bias is permeated through contemporary really awful movies like Agora. I mean, Rachel Weisz is a great actress, but that movie, have any of you seen that movie? It's very good for falling asleep with, but also total nonsense. And so we're clearly dealing with bias. There's a more sensational one of destruction and disruption, which is of far more interest to historians of antiquity and indeed the contemporary public. We also have some fine literature as well. For example, in the back of this book, we have the Greeks were forced to abandon even their name and call themselves Romans from the 5th to the 19th centuries. Moreover, the Christianization of Greece was a catastrophe that precipitated the fall of Rome and engendered the dark ages of Western civilization. And it goes on to tell us that the Christians made Greece a cemetery, which quite unintentionally preserved the aftermath of their murder and genocide. Harsh words. So to redress the bias, we'll examine data, including mortuary and epigraphic, for Christian groups from the Roman period, and then we'll turn to processes of Christianization with a focus on the Peloponnese in the late antique period. We'll look at evidence for the emergence of Christian groups and examine the routes through which the conversion processes may have developed. Examining a range of other areas such as Crete and Lycia will highlight the comparatively late Christianization of Achaia. Now, it does seem counterintuitive that centres such as Achaia with places like Corinth and Athens would be so late, but it's likely to be a result of lots of external factors, including network connections, particularly things like trade and pilgrimage connections too. So the presence of early Christian communities is attested through a range of literary sources. Letters reveal, as Cavan was saying, letters reveal a variety of views and even levels of religious stringency, as we've seen in the correspondence between Dionysus of Corinth urging the Bishop Pintus of Knossos to be more lenient with his congregation, as recorded by Eusebius, as we know. The names of many of the 4th century bishops are known from the accounts of the ecumenical councils. Bishops from the towns of Sicyon and Patras are known to have attended the Council of Sardica in 344. From the Cyclades, a possible Andrian bishop signed his name Zolus Andro as an attendee of the Council of Alexandria in 362, and in 381, Argos and Sparta were represented at the Council of Constantinople. But even in these communities, there's little archaeological data to show their Christian communities that supported these bishops or vice versa. The earliest evidence for a Christian community in Eleftherna in Crete survives in the form of an inscribed lintel, Nikion ton Kyrion, from a 3rd century house. In other areas, mortuary data provides some of the earliest indications of Christian groups. 3 galleries of catacombs have been explored on Milos, and they're among the earliest clear data for Christian burials in Greece. They're located in the northwest of the island with a clear view of the extensive Thripidi settlement to the north and the sea to the west. The catacombs appear to have been in use from the 2nd to the 5th centuries, and there's some new work going on there, actually. Both two-storied and single chambers are found, and some of the larger examples contained multiple inhumations and likely family groups. In Gallery B, a central shrine dominates the widest space, and throughout the gallery's inscriptions and wall paintings survive too. But these Melian catacombs are a really special example. It's actually more often the case that we have Christian and non-Christian burials found together with indeed interchangeable traditions, as we have seen. Both Ellie and Joe have talked about this. We see it in the case of the North Cemetery in Corinth, for example, but also indeed in Attica and Athens. There was something of a slow Christianization in Christian burials, which took the form of the east-west orientation of the body and exclusion of grave goods, with the exception of those on clothes, so objects that were involved during the burial process or connected with the funerary cult, as Joe has noted. The tradition of placing a coin on the corpse occurred frequently until the 6th century, and graves and sarcophagi were often marked with inscriptions with the presence of a Cairo, a cross, or other Christian symbol, as we've seen in the inscriptions just now. The dedication might comprise the name of the deceased and other personal family details, including occupation and religion. And for example, we've got the carpet weaver and Menas and his wife Constantina from Argos. As one might expect, a mixture of traditional forms of names and conventions continued alongside traces of the new ideology of salvation and resurrection, as we've seen. Hybrid traditions are also notable in the epigraphic record, where we talked about this earlier on, where curses are found either in Christian burials or sometimes on gravestones, suggesting that you better not touch the grave or you'll be cursed. The fleas of 1,000 camels will infest your armpits or something like that. There are several examples from Argos, one such as the 4th century example, and gravestones bearing anathema from Corinth too. Many of the decorative themes found in wall paintings, such as feasts and birds and landscapes, would have been familiar in these decorated tombs. We have an example of one from Aurelia Procla on Thessaloniki. And we see also continuation of Christian imagery on things like non-Christian imagery on things like reliquaries. So, for example, we've got the Three Graces dancing from Thessaloniki here, and this is one of the Sidamara sarcophagi fragments in the Byzantine Museum in Athens, where we've got a philosopher which also could be interpreted as a Christ tomb. In terms of other kinds of evidence, we've already seen lamps, and these lamps range in form from the very kind of subtle use of very plain decoration to more overt things like crosses or Cairo symbols on the lamps. And although graves did not vary greatly, the location of cemeteries did begin to change over time, indicating a modification of use, particularly in urban space. And this is more a modification of use than an ideological shift in terms of the change of the burial. For example, the evidence for late antique graves in what had been domestic space in the Roman period in Corinth, Patras, and Knossos indicate the change in focus of the city, again, as Joe has noted. In addition to more personal evidence for joint traditions, epigraphic evidence highlights wider community scale sharing of ritual space. Rather than an abrupt end to polytheistic practice with the construction of churches, there is in fact a significant overlap. We've already seen this in mortuary contexts, but we'll have a look at these two tarbolic altars, which were found in Athens. The date of the altars, I don't know if Ellie has a different date or suggestion for it, but they suggest that the altars date to the 4th century and even as late as the 4th century, which suggests that the tarbolium was still performed in Athens until the end of the 4th century. Epigraphic evidence also indicates that there was continued cult at and investment in sanctuaries such as Epidavros and Olympia throughout the 4th century, even while there is evidence for a Christian community in those places. The same appears to be true of the Temple of Apollo at Corinth, which is likely to have been still standing in the 6th century CE, when its superstructures apparently were supposedly finally brought down, supposedly by earthquakes. Furthermore, the long-held belief that temples were automatically converted into Christian churches has also been successfully challenged for many other provinces, for Achaia, but for provinces such as Egypt and North Africa too. Christian communities grow throughout the Roman period, and this emergent pattern is seen even in the more intense period of Christianization in the late antique Peloponnese. As an emergent pattern, there are few identifiable triggers or catalysts for the start of the process. As such, it's necessary to explore how a religion, new religion, became so successful and grounded in the community without significant tension. A key element in this incremental Christianization process was the manipulation of memory and tradition to allow smooth transition rather than the more forceful one of closure and destruction of pre-Christian cult, for which we have very little evidence. There was a careful balance to be struck by the initiators of change, sometimes the clergy, as well as those who wanted to maintain their status within the new structure, to take power and make it legitimate without upsetting too many people. On a more everyday basis, Christians needed to situate themselves within tradition to be accepted. And this was recognized as early as even St. Paul, who, as Bucine notes, drew on Greek poetry to add authority to his attempts to proselytize. Furthermore, colleagues such as Yorgos and also Bucine have noted legitimization of Christianity through traditional cult features such as oracles. I argue here that this is also manifested through the considered location of churches throughout the Peloponnese, and as we'll see later, in other provinces too. Furthermore, an examination of the topography of the Peloponnesian churches provides insights into the more practical elements of Christianization, such as the means and methods by which it spread. So, to briefly turn to the churches now, for Ellie's 40 churches in the Attica, I have about 140 south of that in the Peloponnese. And they're a huge variation in the type. I mean, the vast majority have triple aisle single apsed churches, but there's variety in terms of the numbers of aisles, the numbers of annexes, whether there's an atrium or not. This is an example from Epidavros. There's variety in terms of whether there are working elements, say, for example, a cistern. There may be elements of martyr cult too, which are shown in the architecture. In terms of function as well, we have lots of different variety. There are martyria churches, there are cemetery churches, for example, the Rani and the Mani. If any of you have been there, it's the most snake-infested place I have ever been. It's nasty, don't go there, unless you're wearing really thick boots. And they vary in size from the massive football pitch-sized Legion Basilica to the very tiny Ayas Andreas, which is also in the Mani, but in the less snake-infested part of the Mani. In terms of then what I've been looking at in terms of kind of the spread of Christianization kind of noticed by the church building themselves, the earliest churches, we could argue, are placed in ports and on the edges of sanctuaries. And the reason why we say that is in terms of the emergent pattern is that the change is always going to take place in places where we've got a population that's already used to new ideas. And if you think about the ports and indeed sanctuaries, that's where we have the most cosmopolitan of the population are going to be gathering there. In order to spread these ideas, in order to have these ideas accepted, you have to have regular flows of traffic. And we see very clearly then that we have these earliest churches at the site of Epidavros, at the site of Olympia. It's worth stressing that the two churches built at the site of Olympia and the site of Epidavros are not built in the sanctuary space proper. They're built on the edges of the sanctuary space. It's also worth stressing that the sanctuaries that are no longer in use, so sanctuaries that are closed, do not have churches built beside them. So they're very clearly drawing on places that already have regular population going to them. The other places that I said were ports, so for example, Kieto and Hermione here. Other sites then, what happens in the second phase is that we have, this first process is called complexity, where it's sharing properties and adapting to these new ideas. The next process in terms of emergent change is social movement, where ideas are spreading in part through social networks, in part through competition, social competition, and it's a tension against sometimes a dissipating quality of life, which I'm not sure that we've been able to identify fully here, but it's the sense of striving to have what others already have. And so this second phase can be identified by the blue dots here with connections to the original siting of the original churches and sanctuaries and ports, and then they spread out through those networks, and those networks are connected to those original sites. So these churches are constructed, the second phase, in major cities with formal status, and particularly those already close to the sanctuaries or where churches are already present. Now, it's likely, so for example, Argos, and you can see that the earliest churches in Argos are also constructed on the edge of the city, as far as we can tell, and then there's a move in into the city. It's likely that the church would have pandered to this idea of social exclusivity through the construction of the architecture, by making the church very attractive, but by also enclosing some of parts of the ceremony so that it wasn't necessarily fully visible to all, making it tantalizing, making people want to become part of what's going on inside. So you kind of shroud parts of it in mystery, making it more attractive. And then tiered space, of course, is also going to help in terms of maintaining that social status that was so important too. The third phase, though, in terms of an emergent pattern, as this process of tipping point. And this is the slowest part of the Christianization process, where you have the move into the rural areas in the Peloponnese, where finally these areas, which are the slowest to change, the most narrow-minded, finally, they have a swell of churches all around them, and then you start getting the construction of churches within these rural areas as Christianity becomes much more popular. So the crucial point, actually, with these rural churches, and I suspect it might be the same in your case, Ellie, as well, is that we have the rural churches are constructed in highly visible areas, so you can see them from all around, and they're also helping to mark the landscape. So, for example, Ayas Yordas in Iraqi has 360 views, too. The crucial point with the identification of these phases, it means that there are several elements of Christianization that can be realized without being too compartmentalized. It's multidirectional. So different groups can steer the process at different times. So you can have church, or you can have local elite, or even local people on the ground who are deciding or making decisions about the spread of the construction of churches. It also allows, as we'll see, for a great deal of regionalization. Under the umbrella of emergent, the three phases of conversion are not necessarily tied to a particular chronological range, but you can have the different process happening at the same time in different regions. And it allows for diversity of change in accordance with new and developing social changes, such as new religious practice. So for the Peloponnese, it's notable that throughout the process that temple structures are left standing without much interference. And those that are converted much later in the process. So we seem to have a situation where, again, there's a certain kind of tipping point where we have a large construction, high density of construction of churches, and then and only then are the temples converted into churches. I thought this was going to be a great pattern, but in fact, I don't have it everywhere that I've been looking at. If we have a look at the Synecdoche, Heracles Synecdoche, and the Pudengeria map, we can see how these phases will work internally too. So here we've got the construction. Well, let's take a focus, for example, on part of the Carinthia and the Argolid. You can see that the earliest churches are constructed in the main towns. And then in terms of the networks, they're following the networks as defined in the Bungeriana map too, as we can see here. It's important to note, too, that the expansion of churches is not going to go crazy into mountains, so they're sensible about where they're putting them. But as Ellie had pointed out, there's also networks of churches along routes as well. Although it's possible to see how the churches bring with them a potential for formalized Christianization, what the processes don't explain is how they were activated and encouraged. In each case, visibility is key, no matter what the location of the church is, but that's not enough. Communities need encouragement to adopt the new religion, no matter how peacefully, and this is where the role of memory manipulation comes in. Throughout the different Christianization phases, memory and tradition were managed by the church in terms of its location, architecture, and rituals. And it's argued that the church consciously maintained certain traditions of place, imagery, and action in order to retain and use memory traces from the established religious action structures. To help situate the Christian church as a central element of community life and identity. Memories are based on experience and tradition, so they can easily be used in transit to a new experience or agenda by exploiting a similar location or architectural form and presenting common imagery. According to Boyer, traditions are groups of recurrent acts which are perceived as fundamental cultural models. In this respect, participation in traditional activities associated with a cult site, for example, will create an implicit memory which can be triggered by repeated actions. Repeated rituals such as procession, ritual dining, and perhaps chanting are central to this notion. And collective memory is controlled and uses cross-cueing. So agents orchestrate and order elements of collective memory, so for example in deciding location of church or choice of imagery. Since memory is progressive, collective memories which retain certain cultural traditional values can be transferred to a new establishment as long as there are some consistent triggers. And that many of the new churches were located in the regions of pre-Christian cemeteries or above agricultural land emphasize kinship connections, thereby giving further credibility to the church. So, for example, many of the churches that we see in the Peloponnese are located by points of natural beauty or gathering points, collection points for water, and many of them are located in pre-existing cemeteries, which may be using martyria. and on the edges of town, particularly by gateways as well. So they're located on routeways, so they're highly visible, and then indeed, as we've already said, beside sanctuaries as well. So if we very quickly illustrate with Epidavros, we see here, this is the propyle on main entrance into the sanctuary, pre-Christian sanctuary here, which you can see on the overland view here, and the main church is located here. So you can't help but, when you're crossing into the Propylaea, you can't help but see the Basilica Church itself just over to the left as you're crossing in. So it's already, you've got the route of the procession is already there, and if you're going to continue maintaining that route of procession, it wouldn't have been all that difficult just to take a turn left into the space of the where the church was. Here, although sacrifice may have been banned, it's clear that the Theodosian Code says that processions were allowed to continue, so the same routes of worship could be taken. Although details of the participants in the church procession are lacking, it can be postulated that the same kinds of hierarchy would have been continued to be expressed, perhaps with the elites being replaced by the clergy. Within the church space, we would have seen stratification would have continued, and mosaics and architecture would have helped order the space within too. In the Epidavros Church, the altar was at the back in the holy area, and so you wouldn't have necessarily been able to see what was going on, but the element of mystery would have helped trigger various reactions, as would have been ritual elements within the church and chanting, potentially, as we've seen. In the last section, I'd like to stress that comparative analysis with other regions shows that there is some variation on these patterns, which can be explained in part by different topographies and network connections, in addition to the nature of pre-existing cult. So the reason why I did this comparative analysis was to prove how right I was, to find that I was wrong. So we'll have a look at comparative analysis, which in other words can be called diversity. So we'll have a look at the diversity of other areas. Serardi suggests that the polytheistic practice was more persistent in the Greek provinces due to a number of factors, including a respect for cultural traditions and the presence of philosophical schools. But network connections, of course, played a significant role, such as the conduit for the proliferation of Christianity. Network connections could be made in a variety of ways, including the ever-important pilgrimage. There are a surprising number of Ampulae and Thessalian Thebes, which may help to explain how it became such a massively bustling city with 8 churches in the late antique period. Many of the Cilician churches also appear to have benefited from pilgrimage traffic, and there's huge numbers of them, in particular those connected with Thecla, and like Thessalian Thebes, the otherwise unassuming location of the site may have otherwise gone unnoticed. And both sites have 4th century churches. The Cycladic Islands and Crete also have evidence for early churches, but this may be explained by trade connections rather than pilgrimage, although pilgrimage can't be ruled out for some of the churches. So, for example, the church... picture? No, I don't. The church of... I do. The church of the KMF Basilica, which I've already talked about, and the church of the Catapoliani on Paros as well. While the topography and location of a region may enable network connections, such advantages needed to be acted upon, or they become redundant. So, for example, Tinos, which would have been perfectly placed for lots of connections between the mainland of Greece and the Cyclades, it doesn't seem to have any evidence for a late antique church there yet. It's equally likely the case that network connections can be made and encouraged even in unlikely topographic circumstances. For example, in the mountains of Lycia, which I can show you in a minute, I'm sorry. And there we go, from the mountains of Lycia. As long as the desire and means and other mitigating factors were there, such as presence of resources. Once the impetus for church planning takes hold in the Peloponnese, it follows network hubs such as ports and Panhellenic sanctuaries. And a degree of strategic planning is seen in these initial foundations, and it's used to capture an audience without alienating the population. In contrast, the earliest churches in Crete are founded on the edges of major cities like Knossos and Gorton, and it's regardless of their location. So I thought I was going to find loads of early churches on the ports in Crete, but I didn't. I found them in the major cities of Knossos and Gorton. The other churches are also found along the routes through the island. So, for example, in the Amari Valley, there's a whole string of churches along the Amari Valley, and you see one of them here at Vizari. This implies that, in contrast to the Peloponnese, different kinds of network connections are in action, and that the church constructions were unintended byproducts of social movement. More likely, they were a result of this local instigation than imperial edict. The topography of the churches indicates that the Christianization of Crete was less about the results of strategic policy and more about the results of unplanned circumstances. The same may actually be true of Lycia, where the earliest churches are found in major cities as well, in cities such as Xanthos and Arikanda. And in both cases, but particularly in Lycia, internal routes are highlighted through church location, some of which may have actually functioned as satellite churches. Monasteries have played a significant role here, but I'm not going to go into detail on that. In many of the Peloponnesian cities discussed, as well as in Athens and Thessaloniki, the earliest churches are found on the edge of towns. They occupied highly visible locations, such as on main gates or routes to the cemeteries, without encroaching on existing buildings. The location of the first churches in Thessaly and Thebes actually provide a good contrast to this, where, unlike other cities, the first churches are actually intramural. So we've got the earliest churches in Thessaly and Thebes are constructed within the walls. So you've got Basilica B here, which is in here, and then Basilica A, which is here. So we have another contrast. As a new city, and this may be why they're built within the walls, as a new city, the lack of pre-existing traditions gave the city more freedom to construct the churches within a centre, and also you don't have the same level of pre-existing cult here either. As I've argued for the Peloponnese, the repurposing of temples for Christian use does not happen until late in the Christianisation process, almost only when the memory of their uses have been completely sidelined. You know, three generations and the memory goes, apparently. Not individual memory, but collective memory. This seems to be reasonably common in certain locations. As I've already said, we see it in Egypt, North Africa, Lycia, and Crete. But, unfortunately, this is actually the site of Latoun in Lycia, and this is the Asclepion at Libena in Crete. But this is not the case, as far as we know, for Cilicia, where we have a number of churches built directly on top of temples, early churches built directly on temples. And indeed, as Yorgos would argue, the same applies to the sanctuary of Demeter at Naxos as well, where the conversion of the temple into a church happens pretty early on in the process. Although the widespread construction of churches is perceived as a significant change in society, in many respects it's not as dramatic as it might seem on the surface. Just as the slow process of religious change in the other periods also melds into existing society. In choosing their locations, church builders were using a social as well as a spiritual process to implement the change in religion. The course of Christianization is diverse and was dependent on topography, existing sacred landscape, and individuals. And it's this kind of diversity that emergent processes account for. There are elements of commonality, such as the importance of visibility, the use of routes, but there are also very distinct elements, say, for example, the reuse of temple spaces. But in all cases, both places and spaces, including the art and architecture, are manipulated somewhat organically through location, but are active through use, and this would have created a different experience of the present by making memories of the past less meaningful, while still maintaining the strength of the new community identity without a risk of attention-based conversion through new social memories and folky. Thank you.
Thank you very much for an extremely wide-ranging presentation of the archaeological and topographic evidence. Again, I open it to the audience to ask questions or contribute observations. Well, I'll start the ball rolling if nobody's. Oh, no, we've got a question.
Only probably at your list, in your list with early churches in Peloponnese. You should add Messini.
Yeah.
I think there's recent research there, and they have found a 4th century church.
That's right. I was hedging my bets a wee bit with Mazzini there, all right. And I wasn't aware that they have finally decided that was...
Yes, Nikos Tsivikis in his PhD. Yes.
Excellent.
And I think he's right.
Okay. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you so much for your lecture. I would like to ask something about the patronates of the churches or the names of the churches. In most of the times, we don't have any name, but sometimes we have. And it's my impression that there exists a lot of time continuity to pagan antiquity. That means, names are somehow baptized names of pagan idols, pagan deities. Could you tell us something about this? For example, the Church of St. John in Epidaur was, is it somehow a continuity to the topic of the place?
So, that's a massive debate, and some people would argue that continuity of cult happens with Panagia and Athena, in some respects, I think that's again another regional element of what's going on. Other people would argue that there's continuation of cult specifically at healing sanctuaries, but that's not always the case. So, for example, you have at what's the healing sanctuary in Attica? Amphirion. There isn't a church at the Amphirion. And that was in use right up until quite a late period too, 3rd century. So, I don't think you can generalize about whether or not there's necessarily continuity like that. And also, the ascription of pre-Christian connections like that, they'd come from historical sources. So it's very hard to say whether it was actually a connection and whether it's kind of later Christian sources saying, oh, look, it was always going to have some sort of connection here and situating it in at a later point, or whether it was an earlier situation. And even places like in Tyrrhea, where you've got epigraphic evidence, there's no really good evidence to tie it directly to the church, too.
I'll put my question on which was... I understood that the main you put forward an argument in the first half of the paper that the spread of Christianity could be explained on the hypothesis that it first established itself, led to the building of churches in ports and sanctuaries with a high turnover of incomers and therefore a turnover of new ideas, and that this was the essential sort of Anschluss, as it were, to the development of Christianity, and then you begin to follow it out through networks of roads into other areas. But then in the second half of your paper, you moved to other areas and said, hold on a moment, my model is not working here, in Crete specifically, but perhaps in other areas, which to me sort of raises the sort of somewhat doubts about these hypotheses at all as a methodological tool for going forward. And just put the simple point that in the area that I know, which is Central Asia Minor, it's completely the reverse of the Northern Achaean situation that you describe. That is to say that the earliest examples of Christianity were the areas where it seems to have got established and really established early and quickly are in the most conservative areas, which are not exposed to high traffic from outside, and where the local people, as it seems, have somehow integrated whatever was important to them about Christian ideas into a way of life that they then proceeded to develop. And so I suppose this is an observation, but rather than a question, but I suppose the central point is that I'm uneasy about the use of these sociological hypotheses, because for every sociological hypothesis that you can advance to explain a sort of only partly documented phenomenon, you can find another one which might point in completely the opposite direction.
So thank you. And I mean, this is, I was finding different things in particularly island contexts and things like that. But I think what I was trying to get at more was that you can use these same processes to talk about different points. So I think there's imperial instigation and local instigation, and you can use the process to talk about that rather than seeing a top-down or a bottom-up a dichotomy. But I also think that what it allows you to do is talk much more about the topography and how the topography fits in with local communities. And so what I see, which is probably what I should have emphasized at the end of this, what I see is not necessarily massive differences in these communities. What I see is differences in networks and differences in topography. And the networks in Crete are quite different from those in the Peloponnese. And so it's the cities, it's the big cities that have most contact in Crete rather than the port cities. And that's always been the case with Knossos and Goetin as well. And there are no those big sanctuary sites in Crete either. And so that's why I was looking at all those individual places, whereas Lycia is much more akin to what's going on in the Peloponnese in that respect.